Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
We're here tonight to give you a little bit of news and also to play our interview from last night. Our interview is with Larry Dorman. He's the Public Affairs Coordinator for Council 4 here in Connecticut, AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And he gives us the union view on what's happening, what the union is supporting, and that'll be on at about 8:30. And until then, we're going to bring you a little bit of alternative news, starting right now with this report from LouRockwell.com. Conspiracy Theorists Were Right, by Gary D. Barnett. The Department of Homeland Security is warning law enforcement officials about a rise in right-wing extremist activity. But a footnote in this report by the Homeland Security Office of Intelligence and Analysis defines right-wing extremism as including not just racist or hate groups, but also groups that reject federal authority in favor of state or local authority. If I'm interpreting this correctly, this report is going after anyone who dares to question federal authority. This would put libertarians directly in the government's crosshairs. In fact, I have been against federal authority my entire life, so I am a prime target. In addition, this report was sent to police and sheriff's departments all over the country. This is after thousands of combat troops have taken up permanent residence as domestic police, with thousands more on the way. This sounds like nothing more than a recipe for tyranny. The government's destruction of liberty has been with us for generations, but due to the incremental nature of this assault on freedom, in the past, most people paid little attention. But now our liberty is being pushed aside like a bulldozer mowing over anthills. Is anyone other than LRC readers and small libertarians watching? That's LouRockwell.com readers. In the past, I have talked about illegal wiretapping, illegal spying, government-private spying partnerships, InfraGuard, thought crime legislation, financial transaction monitoring, anti-money laundering legislation, immoral taxation policies, and privacy invasions, among many other government indiscretions. And many thought that I was too negative or even too cynical. I even wrote an article about pending legislation that would allow the government to round us all up and put us in federal camps. Now, after just recently seeing the leaked Missouri Strategic Report, MIAC, the Department of Homeland Security is informing police to be on the lookout for anyone who would not be in favor of federal authority. Orwell, as a prognosticator, has been well vindicated, more so than even he probably could have imagined. I write this today after just learning this morning that in Billings, Montana, population 100,000, that the Yellowstone County Sheriff's Department rolled out its new 13-foot-tall, 35,000-pound ballistic-engineered armored response vehicle. Bear. Purchased with, you guessed it, a Homeland Security grant. It is to be used not only by the Sheriff's Department, but also by the Billings Police Department. They got this war machine just in time to tame those who are not in favor of federal authority. It is bulletproof, has 2-inch shatterproof glass, and gun ports on both sides. This idiocy is going on all over the country. And why aren't more people fearful of this military arming of local police? I don't know. In order for normal citizenry to defend themselves from the onslaught of military weaponry, rifles and shotguns will be needed to be traded in for bazookas and handheld rocket launchers. Unfortunately, these are still illegal. If you want to continue to hide your head in the sand, Don't dare connect these dots. We now have militarized police, combat soldiers on our streets, war zone materials and weaponry in the hands of domestic government agents, FEMA camps, and a neutered rule of law. These atrocious changes have happened quickly and at a civil restlessness. Is this a coincidence? I think not. Everything happens for a reason, and this time that reason is easy to spot. Are you looking? If not, you had better open your eyes soon. Gary Barnett is the president of Barnett Financial Services, Incorporated in Lewistown, Montana. And he wrote that article for lewrockwell.com.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine why Billings, Montana would need an engineered response vehicle.
Well, they got it for whatever. It was a red state. They got money. And,
yeah, it's pretty scary.
Well, you know, the problem that they have there is that Montana and all of these other places are known for patriot movements. They're known for people that are,
States' rights.
For states' rights and things like that. So, you know, they're targeting.
They're getting
those,
ready to
target those people.
Make
now,
an assault on those people? Do you think?
I think why would you need an
armored response vehicle with 2-inch shatterproof glass and gun ports on both sides in the middle of Montana?
No, I'm not justifying that, but I'm saying that the fear that they have is that, you know,
government fear.
The government's fear is that there are going to be people that are going to be, you know, civil unrest over this stuff.
Mm.
And there's already a lot of civil unrest. And that civil unrest, believe it or not, isn't brought to you by liberal talk shows. It's brought to you by conservative talk shows, you know. And, you know, we're pissed off that Obama got into office, all right? And that's basically what they have.
I personally don't think they'd be any happier with John McCain, the conservative.
Oh, they would have been thrilled. Oh, yeah, sure. God, Palin. In fact, I got an article on Palin here that, you know, this wolf-killing vampire from Alaska, you know, is...
I'll have to read that.
Yeah, and... in fact, you might want to read that now since we're on the topic. It's not that long.
Governor Palin to be greeted by aerial wolf hunting ad campaign on a visit to Evansville, Indiana. When Governor Sarah Palin arrives in Evansville, Indiana tomorrow, she will be greeted by the latest installment of Defenders of Wildlife Action Fund's Eye on the Palin campaign. TV and print ads will run all day on April 16th, 2009, I guess they did, to ensure that Evansville residents are aware that she promotes the shooting of wolves from airplanes, as well as gassing wolf pups in their dens. Since Governor Palin is making the rounds pushing her own agenda, we wanted to give residents of Evansville the full picture and highlight the more extreme portions of her agenda, commented Defenders Action Fund President Roger Schickerson. Sorry. It's very small print. Whenever she may say on her trips across the lower 48, Governor Palin's aggressive pursuit of increasingly extreme wildlife policies, such as shooting of wolves from airplanes and gassing wolf pups in their den, voices her values well outside those held by most Americans. Launched in 2009, www.ionpalin.org was set up to track Governor Palin's extreme anti-conservation agenda. In less than 3 months since the website launch, Palin's administration and the Board of Game has approved, among many things, the use of helicopters by private hunters to shoot wolves and the use of poison gas to kill wolves and their pups in the dens. They even have butted heads with the National Park Service over their decision to shoot wolves that largely reside in a national preserve, some of which were part of a year-long scientific study. Governor Palin is pursuing her anti-science, anti-conservation policies in Alaska at breakneck speed. So while they're shaking hands with the governor, We hope the residents of Evansville will also ask her about her extreme agenda, continued Schickelson. She hasn't listened to the nearly 200 scientists and wildlife experts who wrote to her and asked her to stop her unjustified serial killing program. Maybe she'll listen to the good people of Indiana.
Okay.
I hope they were able to say something to her.
Oh, that behind there was this ad. But this is the ad that's running. It says, you can see this on ionpalin.org. And the ad is three little wolves, a picture of three little wolf pups. It said, would you throw a poison gas bomb into a den of wolf pups? Alaska Governor Sarah Palin and the administration has approved the use of poison gas bombs to kill wolf pups in their dens.
Mm.
Her board of game... Also,
they do this in Alaska, huh?
Yeah. Also recently approved the use of helicopters to intensify the wolf slaughter from the air.
I don't think I like her.
No. And this is a pro-life evangelical, all right? You know, which is the hypocrisy of this woman.
But she doesn't care about any other life on the planet.
No. God, no. And this is not only morally repugnant, but threatens a long-term National Park Service research study aimed at gathering needed data on predators and prey in Alaska. And it's all part of Governor Palin's ongoing war on wolves. Did we mention that she targets bears, too?
Even
mothers with cubs. Yeah. And it's appalling and totally inconsistent with American values, and it happens only in Alaska. And despite opposition from hundreds of experts who say there is no scientific or other justification, the slaughter continues. And Governor Palin doesn't listen to scientists, but she may listen to you. So please go to ionpalin.org and tell Sarah Palin to stop this senseless slaughter. And I believe they have a petition there on there to stop this mess. So Sarah Palin, I just another incredible example of conservative cacophony of crazies, all right? And, just unbelievable. Now, here's a guy. This is from LouRockwell.com again. I kind of like this website a little because it states he's the premier anti-state pro-market site on the net, whatever the hell that means.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
Pro-market site. I don't know. But anyway, the article is by Don Cooper who wrote on this, but it says, are you kidding me? And I appreciate what this guy's saying because it's so hypocritical. I watched closely all the tea parties all over the country on Wednesday. What a showing of national pride and solidarity. What a showing of subservient compliance and casual indifference. What a joke. The Lafayette Park, Washington, D.C., of all places to protest, the plan was to dump 1 million tea bags in the park. But the brave dissidents never did it because they forgot to get the proper permits. Are you kidding me? What is civil disobedience without civil disobedience?
Yeah, you just dump them in there.
Yeah, they even went so far as to say that they were willing to put down plastic tarps and clean up after themselves. All right? That's like saying, we don't agree with your oppressive, unconstitutional despotism of our nation, and to show our ire. in no uncertain terms, we're going to break public law and disrupt the peace to take, so take that. Na-na-ni-boo-boo.
Na-na-ni-na-ni-boo-boo.
But don't worry, because we'll put everything back when we're done. And if nothing happened, because we don't, we'll put everything back when we're done, as if nothing happened, because we don't want any trouble. And videos on the internet of Lafayette Park show people standing around in their trendy turtlenecks and Tommy Hilfiger and North Face jackets, chatting, socializing, drinking coffee, and talking on their cell phones, some dressed in colonial garb, how cute, and waving flags. And others even break into a rendition of the Star Spangled Banner followed by a chant of USA, USA, USA. What a terrific show of meaningless symbolism. Who are they chanting to? The buildings in front of them? The birds in the trees? Themselves? What was this supposed to do? Because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to surmise that it did nothing. All The politicians were inside, smugly and comfortably seated in their expensive leather chairs that we paid for. They were discussing their next round of special interest pandering and deficit spending at our expense, while we mingled as if at a, well, tea party. But not the sort of 1773, but rather more like the sort at 4 p.m. in England that is served with crumpets.
Yeah.
The politicians could have cared less about the goings-on outside, and no one looked at it and took it to them. Shame on us. No one made sure they took notice. No one was put out one bit. No economic loss to the government whatsoever, as was the purpose of the original Tea Party. So why should they notice? In this, like, is this like giving to a charity? You write a check to feed a starving child for 10 cents a day in some far-off, nameless, faceless country, and you feel better about yourself? I attended a tea party in the Midwest on Wednesday, and there were only about 200 people there, and it was literally a tea party. People came with their coffee mugs and sandwiches, holding signs and standing around and chatting and socializing. Then everyone went home. No passion, no signs of real frustration or discontent, no real commitment to changing anything. You know why? Because nobody wants to fire the first shot. Everybody wants change, but only if they don't have to pay for it. Only if their comfortable lives don't have to be disrupted for their freedom. What a bunch of crap! Then I see all these political pundits, idiots, on CNN talking about how the, you forgot to mention Fox News,
mm-hmm.
Okay, on CNN talking about how the Tea Party movement is nothing more than a partisan Republican conservative movement against the Obama administration, and how the majority of Americans agree with the taxing and borrowing and spending. Some numbnuts, CNN political analyst named Jeff Toobin, says that the Texas state legislative resolution to reaffirm their state sovereignty is a fantasy. Are you kidding me? State sovereignty is a fantasy. Well, I guess that says it all. Come on, everyone, down the rabbit hole. Right? No doubt the majority of Americans didn't want to go to war against the British in 1776, but would anyone say now that it was the wrong thing to do? No doubt the majority of Americans didn't want a civil war, but those wars were, at their core, about state rights, about oppressive governments trying to overreach their authority and impose unlawful mandates on the states. It was about their freedom to do what they wish with their lives. I think we have met the enemy, and it is us. We're a bunch of fast-food-nourished, MTV, anesthetized shopping mall, plug-in drug, a.k.a. television addicts, who will do anything to preserve the way of life, at least until we die. And after that, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
We're cynically obese, socially disconnected, politically inept, and intellectually bankrupt nation of the douchebags who deserve everything they get.
Do you think we're that bad?
We are as bad. We've been saying this forever, Lila.
Yeah.
Come on. Especially the conservative.
I don't think we're a bunch.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead.
Oh, God. The people that run this government and this country and...
Well, the people that run the government, I'm just thinking about the people themselves.
It said, well, let's put it this way. The movement has no leader.
Mm.
When I listen to anyone other than Ron Paul, Peter Schiff, or Lou Rockwell speak about the issues we discuss on LRCLouRockwell.com there,
mm-hmm.
I might as well be listening to any other political party spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
They sound just the same. They dress just the same. They say the same old tired things. Ron Paul has even mentioned at times that Libertarian Party has become just another political party, interested in more in their political posturing rather than liberty.
Mm-hmm.
They have all the same sorts of infighting and power struggles that are symptomatic of the fact that they have lost their way. And rallying the troops to vote more like-minded individuals into office won't work. That's an old failing strategy. When will someone step forward with the courage, character, wisdom, and intelligence to lead our nation to the 21st century, blah, 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 and centuries away our forefathers led into the 19th century. Well, that's kind of true. And he goes on and on and on and on and on and on.
Well,
he's
why doesn't he take
rant,
the lead?
But, you know, I don't know. He's not, he doesn't want to do that because he's saying he's one of those guys too. Okay, basically. Or maybe we won't. I'll just read the last one. It probably says it all. Or maybe we don't want to risk our children's well-being now, so we defer it until they're adults and let them deal with the fact that they can't afford college or health care or home without going to enormous debt, and we never teach them the importance of things like character, honor, integrity, truth, and freedom, but rather teach them how to live in fear and how important it is to get a good job and play by the rules and go along to get along, and that will be safe. We're pathetic. And he counts himself in there as well. But the guy is a Florida native, Navy veteran, and Oxford educated economist living and working in the Midwest.
Yeah. It could be too dumb.
No. But he's blaming himself as well. And,
yeah,
you know, people
not
probably,
unlike all of us.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, people wonder why we do what we do and why we say what we say. I wanted you to read that one on this.
Oh, okay.
If you don't mind.
You know,
and
I can't see it, Leo. I hate to tell you. Yeah, I can't. Unfortunately, folks, even with glasses, some of the printing is so. I have to get new glasses. I just can't see some of it. But let me read this.
I got a large magnifying glass
that
can help you.
Oh, this print is nice on this.
Can you see anything through that?
Yeah, see, look at that. I can read that.
Oh, you want to read it? Okay.
No, not enough, though.
All right,
it's too wavy.
I'll read it.
Let me read this one. Shortage of EMO. This isn't my type of article, but Leo got it. McClatchy, Washington Bureau.
Well, actually, let's see. We got 10 minutes. All right. Go ahead. If you can read that, it's a short article.
Okay. Most days are like Christmas for Glenn Furtado. When he opens boxes sent to the Winchester Gallery gun store in East Fort Worth, he finds out what ammunition he'll have to stock his shelves with that day as demand for weapons and ammo soars. Reports of heavy sales at gun stores began around the time of Barack Obama's election as president. And months later, dealers are facing ammo shortages nationwide. People are panicking and buying, since Furtado, assistant manager. The crime rate is high, and they are flat scared of what is going to happen in the next few years with the economy and the country. Manufacturers weren't prepared for this. Retailers and consumers say there may be several reasons gun stores are running out of ammunition, and the cost of what is available is rising. There's a widespread expectation that Obama's administration will follow through on a campaign promise to reimpose an assault weapon ban. Some people fear that taxes on ammunition, guns, and other firearms-related materials might drastically increase, as they have on cigarettes. Administration officials and Democratic leaders in Congress began saying this month, and while they hope to eventually change gun control policies, they will not push the assault weapon ban for now because they know how divisive that debate would be, and they don't want to distract from other goals.
I was going to read this one article here, but I think this one is more important. The time we have left.
Okay.
Up at 8:30, we have an interview with Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union. A little insight into what's going on. How the union looks at things. And
we get their perspective on things through Larry.
That's the AFSCME Union, which is probably the largest union in the country. This one here. But it was from globalresearch.ca, and it's an explanation about Obama's, it's a different look at what Obama's real plan for South America is all about. And I thought it was relevant. I thought it was good because, you know, as much as I appreciate what Obama was doing to some degree, opening up relationships, there's really so little change in his policies.
American foreign policy is still the same as it was under Bush, actually.
It hasn't really changed because you get the same people doing the foreign policy. You got the CFR and the trilateralists, and you got neocons in Barack Obama's cabinet. You got all these same jerks that were advising Bush. Okay, except thank God you get Dick Cheney is gone, but and George Bush himself, but. You got pretty much the same people who are following the same basic agenda. right? And but this particular article pretty much states that at first glance, Obama seems to have softened U.S. policy toward Latin America, especially when compared to his predecessor. There has been no shortage of editorials praising Obama's conciliatory approach while comparing it to FDR's good neighbor Latin American policy. It's important to remember, however, that FDR's vision of being neighborly meant that the U.S. would merely stop direct military interventions in Latin America whilst reserving the right to create and prop up dictators, arm and train unpopular regional militaries, and promote economic dominance through fee trade and bank loans, conspire with right-wing groups, etc. And although Obama's policies toward Latin America has a similar subversive feeling to it, many of FDR's methods of dominance are closed to him. Decades of U.S. good neighbor policy in Latin America resulted in a continuous string of U.S.-backed military coups, broken debtor economies, and consequently a hemisphere-wide revolt. Many of heads of state, like Obama, mingled with at the summit of the Americas came to power because of the social movements born out of opposition to U.S. foreign policy. The utter hatred of U.S. dominance in the region is so intense that any attempt by Obama to reassert U.S. authority would result in a backlash, and Obama knows it. Bush had to learn this the hard way when the pathetic attempt to tame the region led to a humiliation in the 2005 summit, where for the first time Latin American countries defeated yet another U.S. attempt to use the Organization of American States as a tool for U.S. foreign policy. But while Obama humbly discussed hemispheric issues on an equal footing with his Latin American counterparts at the recent Summit of Americas, he has subtly signaled that U.S. foreign policy will be business as usual. And the least subtle sign that Obama is towing the line of previous U.S. governments, both Republican and Democrat, is his stance on Cuba. Obama has postured as being a progressive when it comes to Cuba by relaxing some travel and financial restrictions while leaving the much more important issue, the economic embargo, firmly in place.
Yeah, and that's cruel.
Yeah. And when it comes to the embargo, the U.S. is completely unpopular and isolated in the hemisphere. The U.S. two-party system, however, just can't let the matter go. And the purpose of the embargo is not to pressure Cuba into being more democratic. This lie can be easily refuted by the numerous dictators the U.S. has supported in the hemisphere, not to mention dictators the U.S. is currently propping up all over the Middle East and elsewhere. And the real purpose behind the embargo is what Cuba represents. To the entire hemisphere, Cuba remains a solid source of pride, defeating the U.S. Bay of Pigs invasion while remaining fiercely independent in the region, dominated by U.S. corporations and past government interventions, has made Cuba an inspiration to millions of Latin Americans. The profound break from U.S. dominance in its own backyard, no less, is not so easily forgiven. There is also a deeper reason for not removing the embargo. The foundation of the Cuban economy is arranged in such a way that it threatens the most basic philosophic principle shared by the two-party system, the market economy, or capitalism. And although the fight against communism may seem like a dusty relic from the Cold War era, the current crisis of world capitalism is again posing the question, is there another way to organize society? Even with Cuba's immense lack of resources and technology, the achievement made in healthcare, education, and other fields are enough to convince many in the region that there are aspects to the Cuban economy, most notably the concept of producing to meet the needs of the Cubans and not for private profit, worth repeating. Hugo Chavez has been the Latin American leader most inspired by the Cuban economy, and Chavez has made important steps toward breaking up the capitalistic economic model and has insisted that socialism is the way forward and much of the hemisphere agrees. This is the sole reason that Obama continues the Bush-era hostility toward Chavez. Obama has been less blunt about his feelings toward Chavez, though he has publicly stated that Chavez exports terrorism and is an obstacle to progress. Both accusations are, at best, petty lies. And Chavez drew the correct conclusion of the comments by saying, he, Obama, said I'm an obstacle for progress in Latin America, therefore I must be removed, this obstacle, right? It's important to point out that while Obama was listening and learning at the Summit of Americas, the man he appointed to coordinate the summit, Jeffrey Davidow, was busily spewing anti-Venezuelan venom in the media. The disinformation is necessary because of the threat that Chavez represents. The threat here is against U.S. corporations in Venezuela, who feel correctly that they are in danger of being taken over by the Venezuelan government to be used for social needs in the country. Obama, like his predecessors, believed that such an act would be against U.S. strategic interests. Let's link in the private profit of mega corporations acting in a foreign country to the general interest of the United States. In fact, this belief that the U.S. government must protect and promote the U.S. corporations acting abroad is the cornerstone
of our
U.S. foreign policy.
Not
only in Latin America, but in the world.
And that's wrong.
Yeah, it is wrong. I mean, we don't have the right to go out there and exploit all these damn countries.
If these corporations want protection, then go hire your own people.
Yeah, Blackwater or some of these other places.
Yeah.
Why should we hire it for them? You know, they're just plotting. They're just exploiting the people and causing problems all over the world, and you know, trying to steal resources. And, yeah, and we why should we support that? I don't know.
I think it's wrong to support it.
Why can't governments be on par with each other and deal straight with each other? I don't know. But you know, that's part of it.
We don't even have two political parties that deal straight with
each other.
It's all a great joke.
Yeah, it is a great joke.
And they don't even deal straight with the people here.
Yeah, and basically what he's saying is
that's a very good article.
Yeah, that we're supporting the same damn thing that Bush did and everybody else did. And in the last paragraph, which is important, it says also that Barack Obama is supporting the Mexicans and the Colombians, all right, which have right wing dictatorships, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Right wing, they disguise dictatorships. What these actions make clear is that Obama is continuing the age-old game of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. Though less directly than previous administrations, Obama's attempt at good neighbor politics in the region will inevitably be restricted by the nagging demands of U.S. strategic interests and the demands of U.S. corporations to dominate the markets, cheap labor, raw materials of Latin America. And while it is one thing to smile for the camera and shake the hands of Latin American leaders at the Summit of the Americas, U.S. corporations will demand that Obama be proactive in helping them reassert themselves in the region and requiring all the intrigue and maneuvering of the past.
Yep.
So, yeah, just thought that would be interesting to know.
That's a good article.
It's
a true article.
Yeah.
The only plus I can give Obama is that I don't feel embarrassed when he goes on a trip. At least he behaves in a civil manner. That's all I can say. I don't agree with American foreign policy.
And he doesn't slur his words, and he doesn't...
And he makes a sensible speech, and he doesn't make a spectacle of himself.
He doesn't piss in his hat, and he doesn't... Or shit in his hat.
Well, he doesn't make a spectacle of himself.
Like the other guy did.
Well, Bush couldn't give a straight speech because he's an idiot. And he always made a spectacle of himself. It was embarrassing to
watch
him. He had
horrible table manners, horrible, you know, everything. Everything about this guy was just a disgusting event to watch. And his policies were revolting, repugnant and revolting. I mean, everything about him and everything about his policies, everything about the man. And I hope he burns. I hope they go after him and Cheney and all his damn minions. All right. So anyway, that's what we feel. But right now we got an interview with Larry Dorman, and we're going to play that for you.
I hope you find it informative.
Yeah.
And have a good night, folks.
Yeah. And as Lila exits the stage, we will
put that on.
Yes. So bear with us here 1 second. Thought I had it all set, but not quite. And now, for those of you who might have just joined us, we're going to have Larry Dorman doing his interview with us from last night. Oh, by the way, you can tune in at 8 o'clock, 8 to 10 o'clock on Tuesday nights to WQQQ.com. We now stream live on on the Air on Arathem show, and you can pick that up if you're interested. But right now we're going to see if we can play this interview.
And whatnot. She's a very brilliant author, and we recommend Ellen H. Brown. Just check that out in Google, and it'll come up to her website.
Am I on the right side here? No, of course not.
Large, it swelled to 118,000. And I think Larry is with us. Hi, Larry. Welcome
Larry.
To the show.
Hi, Olivia. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, I was just reading the hidden unemployment numbers in Connecticut.
Pretty alarming.
Yes, that's very scary. According to this article, when all of that is factored in, it's like about 15.6%. That's
very high.
That's very, very high.
Right, and part of the problem, of course, is that when people exhaust benefits, if they qualify, they kind of fall into this netherworld where they're no longer counted.
Yeah, they drop off the radar.
Right,
yeah,
and
people that...
it speaks to the lack of good jobs. It speaks to a lot of problems that clearly the new administration inherited from the previous administration, and that's why we've got to get this thing turned around.
Oh, absolutely.
I just actually saw tonight a piece on, I believe it was on CNN, that showed workers who have been workers 50 and over who have been laid off or, you know, separated from their employment. It's taking six to 7 weeks longer for them to find work than a younger laid-off worker, so that's pretty troubling, too.
Well, the problem is a lot of people didn't realize that was ever going to happen to them, you know.
Right.
And their 401ks went, you know, got hammered and...
Right, they were hoodwinked.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, what are you going to do?
It's very discouraging for a lot of people because, you know, you don't have the same opportunities in front of you when you're over 50 that you have when you're 35.
You know, I think I saw that same thing. That was the one where the lady got Botoxed, right?
Yes.
That was, you know, because...
Yes, because she had to get a job.
Yeah, she felt she had to get a job and compete with younger workers, so it's like, you know, she had to go... She went in for cosmetic surgery, and it was like, yeah, oh, God.
What's that?
Yeah,
that's kind of reduced to, and I suppose she could afford the Botox, but, you know, I'm still...
I guess, but...
More piece of that.
But I don't know, Larry. I don't think it's going to work for me. Botox just... I don't think that's going to make it for me.
Nope.
But anyway, I wanted to talk about a little bit tonight about the new health care proposal there. That, I mean, there's $625 billion in the budget, I guess, proposed budget for next year that he put aside as part of this stimulus plan.
Right.
Have you got any lowdown at all on what that's going to entail or what there might
be? In terms of the health care component?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's kind of up for grabs, and obviously there's been some criticism that it's not, that the Obama plan, you know, isn't a universal a plan, right? You know, it's not based
there's
on still, a
yeah,
single-payer plan.
They still don't seem to get it through their heads that that's the best program, you know? You know, the Medicare and
single payer would be the very best.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. And
look, what needs to be done, and there are certainly components of the Obama plan that address that, but I think that, you know, the issue is you're not going to control, there's no practical way, obviously, to control public health care costs without addressing the private health care cost. And I think that, you know, part of the issue is to get our hands around a lot of things, not just the issue of the administrative component when we're talking single payer, but reforming the way we pay for care, putting technology in place to automate data, because there's a tremendous amount of waste. And part of what you asked about with the Obama package actually has a substantial investment, from my understanding, in health information technology and research, so that you can compare the effectiveness of drugs and medical advice, devices rather, so you have better tracking of a patient's history. And, you know, it's a good start. I mean, let's just leave it at that. It's a good start.
Well, certainly it's not something that's going to be in place right away, that's for sure.
Right, Right. So
it's going to take a few years.
You know, that's our take. Personally, I believe that unless we start getting around the issue, unless we start addressing the need for a single payer system, I just don't know how else we're going to do this.
No. Oh, I agree with you. I know a lot of union contracts are up for negotiation right now.
Right.
What's going on with various municipalities and towns? Are union people finding it tough going?
Absolutely. And there's no no denying that. Around the state, we're being confronted with many fiscal crises, as we are at the state level. State employees just reached a tentative, our state employee coalition has reached a tentative agreement with the rail administration on a $700 million savings plan. And, I want to just pause for a second and before I address what you asked about with cities and towns and say that, nobody else in the state has actually stepped up with any sacrifice the way state employees have. So, it needs to be ratified by membership. But, clearly, the state employees we represent are willing to sacrifice and at least have a debate about the extent of that sacrifice. And it's happening in communities around Connecticut. We have workers, we represent workers on the Board of Ed and towns who are trying to help their cities and towns out. They're taking 0% wage increases, but at the same time, they're trying to get municipalities to stop wasteful spending, to stop expensive consulting and, insurance brokers that get cutting on deals. When you talk about health care, one of the obstacles locally to having a pooling bill where towns like yours in the Northwest section can buy into the state health plan. Part of the obstacles come from insurance brokers who have a lucrative practice with the town. So we're trying to use the fiscal crisis as an opportunity to address the structural management problems that are created because the workers didn't create these problems.
Problems of the system.
Are seeing a pattern of workers we represent accepting 0% wage increases and trying to find other creative ways to make sure that we protect the services we provide, whether it's to school children, to the public. We pave the roads, we pick up garbage, we fix broken water mains, we do all kinds of valuable work. As a school employee, you know that, Lila. We paraprofessionals, school secretaries, administrators. Who provide really valuable services, school nurses, cafeteria workers, and, the people we represent in school systems, they're not rich, they're not making a lot of money, they're not investing in hedge funds, and that's something I can't repeat enough,
Just trying to keep our best
of, ordinary middle-class people, but we are stepping up to the plate to protect services, and it's not easy.
We're the bones of many systems. We're what makes things operate and run. And we're very important.
Well, you're talking about the municipal workers and state and county workers, that's very true.
Right. But, and, the people we represent did not cause this problem. And, that's the bottom line. But we are, in communities around the state, we are at the table trying to help employers get out of this mess. Now, one thing that certainly is a little bit positive in Middletown, for example, we are part of a union coalition that accepted a pay freeze. But in return, we actually demanded that the city accept several recommendations that our union coalition put forward in the way of inefficiency and waste, and they are going to actually incorporate some of those recommendations as part of the agreement. So sometimes there's an opportunity actually to
respond
to the public.
Did they have to take back on health care or health?
They were able to hold off on that, and they were able to get job security.
Right.
And that's generally what we're trying to do because, this is the worst time to cut services.
Right.
To the public, and it's the worst time to cut the people who provide those services. Imagine the schools without people like Lila. They wouldn't work. They just simply wouldn't work.
Now, how did the did any of the those major job cuts that REL proposed become enacted, or were they? I haven't really followed up.
The budget is still
being debated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So at this point, the budget process is going to, in all likelihood, kind of extend through, could very well extend through the summer, possibly even into the fall, but, you know, the state budget deficit does continue to grow, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, I come back to the fact that only one group to date has shown willingness to try and help close the gap, and that's our, you know, our state union coalition, of which AFSCME is a part, so we'll see, and, you know, part of when we, if you don't mind my rambling a little bit, but when we talk about budget, you can't separate that from two other issues, which is here in the state and certainly in the country, which is the issue of revenue
mm-hmm.
And the issue of health care. And that goes back to your question about, you know, the president. You know, the president, and as you said, put aside about, I think it's about $630 billion.
Yeah, something, some extraordinary amount, but...
basically in a reserve fund to help finance reforms in the system. And the reason I'm digressing on this, one of the ways that the Obama administration has proposed to pay for it would be to allow the, I don't know if you know this, to allow the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest 1% to expire in
mm-hmm.
2010 and to eliminate other tax breaks for the extremely wealthy. And that's laudable because you're actually tying revenue reform to health.
I think, you know, I think what they should be doing is putting the, you know, cutting the loopholes for the corporate taxes as well as cutting the loopholes for NAFTA, you know, the loopholes in NAFTA that these corporations can run out of the country.
Well, and that's why, you asked the question about...
pro-NAFTA, this guy, you know?
You know, where is the budget process? And again, you know, state employees, just as in the cities and towns, our employees are stepping up to be part
mm-hmm.
of the solution. But, you know, part of the issue has to be raising taxes on the wealthy who have benefited from the Bush tax cuts, and they're still
yeah.
benefiting despite the Wall Street meltdown, closing loopholes for large corporations, be it Aetna or insurance companies or whomever. And, again, part of the budget debate, given the skyrocketing cost of health care, has to be getting some kind of, you know, universal health care system moving in this state. And, you know, one administratively efficient step would be to allow the municipalities and small businesses and nonprofit employers to buy into the state health plan. And the insurance, big insurance company, the big business, big insurance plan, big business lobbies are fighting that. So it's all tied together. You know, you can't simply cut your way out of the mess we're in. You've got to have systemic reform. And that means revenue reform, taxing people fairly and progressively, and it means fixing a broken healthcare system.
You know, the thing that surprises me, and I don't know if you can address this, but what totally surprises me is the Republican the Republicans are constantly saying that we have the highest corporate tax in the world, okay, and yet we are the wealthiest country, I mean, corporate-wise, in the world, all right? So yet, I don't understand where, I mean, I see all these towns and the cities and states giving these massive, massive tax breaks to corporations for coming into their towns or, you know, developing.
And providing one or two
yeah.
jobs.
I mean, here in, where was it, Norwich, that set up this huge television, but I don't know if it was Universal Studios.
Entertainment kind of.
They gave, well, I don't know how many.
Your money.
Billions of dollars of tax breaks to do this and incentives. And they've done this everywhere.
I find that outrageous. And again,
I do. I remember in city back in the 80s and 90s, I can remember these enterprise zones and these other things that all these cities were giving these corporations to come in. I mean, millions and billions of dollars of tax deferments and tax.
And a lot of that is on promises of employment and
yeah.
jobs, and then
that they never met
and weren't held accountable to.
Or they brought in a bunch of workers from out of the countries. Okay, they're still doing that. Okay, saying they don't have the expertise in these countries. Okay, they need to import hundreds of thousands of people from India or hundreds of thousands of people from other countries in order to fill these jobs.
They're doing it everywhere.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, let me tell you a little story about two very common sense bills that we are championing and that are now dead in the Connecticut state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
One bill, and again, this is, you know, controlled by the Democratic leadership, but we and some community groups are pushing a bill that we're putting two kind of corporate responsibility bills. One of them says that any company applying for taxpayer subsidies, the CEO cannot make more than 25 times the average worker.
Mm-hmm.
Bill. And then the second, but again, only the companies that are applying for your money and mine.
Okay.
The second bill that we've been championing that's died in committee was a bill to suspend any, was to disallow, again, to prevent companies from reaching into our pockets and getting subsidies when they use those subsidies to cut the pensions of their workers.
And that died in committee.
We're simply saying we don't. We need to have standards. No company that has eliminated its pensions, its workers' pensions, no company that pays excessive amounts to its CEO should get my money or yours. And those bills have died. And, you know, we need these standards because, again, I keep harping on it. Our members, you know, people like Lila, who are public employees, did not create this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're constantly being scapegoated and asked to pay, you know, our pound of flesh when in reality it's the corporations and the ultra-rich, and there are many of them in Connecticut, who are getting away with everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why you've got to redress the progressive, the lack of a progressive tax structure. You've got to fix the healthcare system. And you got to stop blaming the workers, who are the only people who seem to buy goods and services locally.
Well, here's another question for you. I'll put you on the hot seat a little bit. I know that Chris Dodd, what do you think his future is? I don't think it's too bright in this state right now, but...
you're not putting me on the hot seat. I mean, look, the one thing I've noticed from the senator is that he is out on the hustings much more aggressively. He's talking about health care. He's talking about fixing the broken financial system. So perhaps he's kind of, you know, learned some lessons from, you know, having lived in Iowa for his, you know, ill-timed presidential run, and perhaps he's learned his lessons from the countrywide.
I would not give this guy another chance. I mean, this guy was part and parcel of the whole, one of the major problems of this whole demise of this economy. He was sitting on the, as a chairman of the banking commission, for crying out loud. All right.
Oh, and I understand the frustration, and, you know, but again, all of this was put into place by the previous administration, and yes, he's, you know, in many ways they're all complicit. But the fact of the matter is, I, as a voter, am looking at the fact that a reactionary right-wing congressman who couldn't hold his seat in eastern Connecticut and who was a, you know, in President, former President Bush's, God, I hate saying that, former, but I like saying former, who was, you know, in the amen corner for Bush, Rob Simmons, is going to run. And, I don't care who if the Democrats put up, whether it's Chris Dodd or if he steps aside and somebody else comes in, Rob Simmons would be a disaster. So I kind of have to step back and look at it that way. And you probably don't like to hear that answer. But that's
I'd like to see somebody run a primary against him, you know.
Well, I'm not, you know, who says that won't happen?
Hopefully it will. But how about the other clown we have in the Senate? Lieberman is almost, he's mute, okay, in the last few months, isn't he?
He's been very quiet, don't you?
Very quiet. You wouldn't even think he existed.
I mean, when they talked about closing down parts of Pratt & Whitney and a few of the projects there, all of a sudden, you know, he saw his face, you know, in the news, but that was it, all right? And it's just amazing how quiet this guy has become, and you know, I especially for a guy with such a big mouth.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's been it's been surprisingly quiet.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to figure out exactly why. Whether it's, he was all gung ho when it was McCain.
Kind of a man without a home, I think.
I think so.
When you say eyes and you bounce around like that and you don't have any fixed causes or beliefs, I think it catches up with you. And, perhaps it's catching up with Senator Lieberman. I just don't see it. I just don't. I think that, it's over for him at the end of this current term that he's finishing out.
Do you think so? I mean, the Republicans were the clowns that were the ones that put him in. In the last election, 75% of all the Republicans in the state voted for Lieberman. Okay, against their own party.
Exactly. So what?
Right. So what did that tell you?
Lamont would be our senator. Were not for that fact. So,
that's right.
Well, I don't think Lieberman has anywhere to go. I think he's riding it out, and unfortunately, he's
at the expense of the people in our state.
Seems to be putting a whole lot of effort right now, wouldn't you say?
I think he's counting his money.
Yeah, I think the guy has just built himself a little bunker there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably down visiting George Bush.
The problem is, also that with the Al Franken situation in Minnesota, where the guy's rightfully been declared.
Oh, like that, yeah.
You know, big business lobby has funded this whole campaign to keep him out. So, we don't have
the proper number.
Wrong voices for working families.
Well, the appeal judge finally ruled against Coleman. This week,
yep.
And said that he can't recount those absentee votes, and the reason is because the absentee votes were thrown out because they were all frauds.
Right.
And now he wants them counted. Okay, as fraud. All right. Even though he lost by 325 votes or something. So unbelievable.
I'm hoping they just put an end to it and let's seat the guy.
Yeah, I mean, give it up. Yeah. But anyway, that's another story. But what do you see for the future of Connecticut here? You think we got one? You think Rawls got a future?
Wow. It's so difficult and risky to do any kind of forecasting because it really, I'm certainly not inside the governor's head. How she handles the economy and, the very personal issues of her health, and that's nobody's business but hers. I certainly have more than my share of philosophical and ideological disagreements with the governor, but she has had some serious health issues for herself and, within her family. So really tough to say what's going to happen in the gubernatorial race.
Another thing that came up recently, and I was kind of surprised, but I heard yesterday that we have a lot of New York listeners for the show, and I was pleased to see that Spitzer is coming back, okay, to some degree. I think he's coming back to fight these bankers.
The bankers, yeah.
Okay, because people realize that he was the guy
that blew the whistle on them.
Yeah, to begin with. But I heard today, or yesterday, I think it was, that Rudy Giuliani, all right, who is a cross-dressing transvestite, okay, well known, he wants to run for governor, but he's also against gay marriage. Now explain that. Okay, the guy is a cross-dresser, well known, and he's had plenty of gay people, gay friends. That
he had two roommates who were gay.
Yeah, but he even walked down Main Street, down Fifth Avenue in the gay parade. Okay, when he was mayor,
right.
and advocating that, and now he's saying he's against gay marriage.
Mm.
Okay, and he's running for governor.
Well, I think he's a joke.
Isn't he a joke? I mean, the guy is the greatest hypocrite that ever walked.
No, I'm not a fan. He's this kind of false long horse guy. I've never seen anybody, profiteer the way he did from a tragedy.
Wasn't that awful?
Horrible 911.
Just millions of dollars this guy made. What did he do? He didn't suffer diseases and illnesses the way those rescue workers did. In fact, he tried to
cover it up.
Part of the whole Republican effort to deny them benefits.
That's right. And on top of that, he was the one that told them not to wear respirators.
When he was mayor, police, firefighters, first responders couldn't get good contracts. He is an anti-worker person to the core, and I think he's a joke. So
he is a major joke.
But let me tell you a quick story. The columnist Jimmy Breslin, author and columnist, I love his stuff. So Jimmy Breslin once described Rudy Giuliani as a little man in search of a balcony. That's my favorite description of a venal politician.
That's very true. But I kind of as bizarre as his term has been, I like Patterson. I do like this guy. I really do. I don't live in New York, so I New Yorkers may have a different opinion, but
like a reasonable, rational.
He seems like it, doesn't he? I'd like to have him as a governor here,
Right, and I would too. And let me tell you, just as one thing, Obama may frustrate us on some issues, but the contrast between him and Bush in terms of the thoughtfulness, the rationality, the willingness to kind of step back and assess and analyze it, it's all very refreshing.
I know he got a lot of criticism in the press for his when he spoke to
I'm going to stop just for 1 second to let our audience know that we got about 30 seconds left of this show while we're streaming. I'm going to play the remainder of the interview. There's about 10 more minutes of it, or 5-10 more minutes, and so you can pick it up in the archives. But I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and please join us tomorrow and Friday at the same time, and we'll continue with the interview now.
It's all very refreshing.
I know he got a lot of criticism in the press for his when he spoke to Hugo Chavez and
right.
for his actions down there. To me, it was refreshing to have someone who could be polite and not embarrass us all.
Exactly, and to say that we have to figure out a way to deal with these people when we don't agree. And,
right. But one thing
I'm also pleased that he's actually trying to thaw relations with Cuba.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Cuban people have suffered immeasurable harm from the embargo, from years of mostly Republican hostility to them as if they were like a threat, which they're not. And I think Obama's people are working behind the scenes to try and, help thaw relations, help pump some economic stimulus money into Cuba and get things moving for the people who suffered, quite frankly, under Castro. And, that's the hallmark of somebody who's kind of thoughtful. And
well, I kind of got a kick out of his brother, Apollo there.
Yeah.
Who said, I'll talk to him about anything he wants. I'll talk to him about everything. And I thought that was
end to that embargo. I can't agree with, for any reason, to have an embargo against the people.
Those poor people are suffering.
Yeah, terrible.
But what we've done under these right-wing, between Mexico and Colombia and
we're financing these right-wing livelihoods and the hopes.
And the death squads under Negroponte and Reagan. Holy cow! Hundreds of thousands of people that were slaughtered down there with American guns,
terrible.
American weaponry and money.
Our blood, blood money and blood arms. It's everywhere.
And we got a friend of ours is a human rights watcher. He's been on the show a number of times, and he's been writing articles about. I believe it's Brazil, where they have plantations down there that they're actually slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They actually still have slaves on these plantations. They don't call them that because what they do is they pay them like $1 a week, and that's about how horrendous.
Oh, in Mexico, it makes things even.
Mexico's the same way.
In that country, we're. It's not just we're financing these right-wing nuts, it's that we're basically they're all tied into the drug trade. Really nefarious.
And the funny thing was the richest man in the world is a Mexican businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's insane. And then, Mexico, you mentioned at the top of the show or top of our interview about trade. And it's done to that country. Driven down the standards of working people.
Oh, it's terrible.
And all different
the
countries.
Policy there has been awful.
It's made things ripe for the drug trade, and it's made things ripe for corruption.
Right.
So all that's on our hands.
Until
sure.
people see it, until people wake up to see this, what's happening there, and I don't know. I mean, this country, you say NAFTA to anybody, they think you're talking about the, who knows.
Thing is just rolling along without any comment in the press, really.
Or in Congress.
In
Congress
seems
to be
any comment
NAFTA,
on. Yep.
It's a frightening policy that was brought about by Clinton and
it's never really examined by Congress, or
they passed it, but it's never been thwarted by anyone.
Oh, and I'm concerned that the,
Democrats or Republicans. I mean, they're both, they've been both as mute.
They never voted on it,
right.
Leo. It just happened.
I know, but they can still do it. They could. Mm-hmm. I mean, Congress can.
They can revisit it. Apparently, Obama's retreating a little bit from his promise to.
Really?
They want what they could do is have side letters of agreement. They can't redo the whole thing, is my understanding, and it could be a little bit off on this. But basically, they could do. signed letters of agreement.
The WTO.
The labor and environmental standards in the administration is sort of maybe doing a bit of a retreat on that. And, you know, that's as long as you have these kinds of trade deals, you're going to have workers getting whipsawed against each other.
But to have the World Trade Organization, actually above the laws, above national laws, okay,